A recent article in the British Medical Journal suggests that diagnoses of major depressive disorders are on the rise. And it also says some cases of depression may be incorrectly diagnosed. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today we talk with two professors of psychiatry and a family medicine physician about the findings of this new study, about how to identify depression and the role of antidepressants. Then in the second half hour, Iowa psychologist and farmer Michael Roseman. Roseman has studied and written about stress and depression among farmers and ranchers. Have you been prescribed an antidepressant? Did it work? Join our discussion after this news. Are antidepressants being prescribed too generously for simple sadness? Are we perhaps medicalizing unhappiness? It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Those are questions based on an opinion piece written by two professors in the British Medical Journal. These authors argue the current criteria for diagnosing depression include wide groups of people with mixed severities of the condition, and therefore these criteria are too broad. They're concerned that the diagnostic criteria are medicalizing what are normal human experiences, grief, and other life stresses. Also concerns when we look at the big picture, that despite studies suggesting the number of people with depression in the general population has stayed roughly the same in recent years, the number of diagnoses of the condition in general practice and prescriptions of antidepressants are increasing. So we want to talk about this hour, about depression, correctly identifying it, and treating it. Perhaps you'd like to join our discussion with a question of your own about depression, the use of antidepressants. Perhaps you or someone you know has been prescribed an antidepressant for any reason. Did it work? 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. Joining us to start off this hour, well, it's the place you might start if you or someone you loved wanted to get an opinion about depression. Dr. Robert Lee is a family medicine physician with the Iowa Clinic. Dr. Lee, welcome to our program.
Thanks, man.
So you are the first line of help for anyone new to this ailment. What's your role when someone comes to your clinic who may have a problem with depression? How do you ascertain that, diagnose it?
Sure. About half the time the patients come in, and they don't come in saying, I'm depressed. That would kind of make it really easy. Often they'll tell us, you know, they have poor concentration, their appetite is upset, they're not sleeping well, they just feel anxious, their thoughts aren't real clear, and sometimes it's not even that. You know, they'll just come in and it just won't feel well, and we'll have to kind of pull it out of them to find out what really is going on.
Mm-hmm. So our concern here is that medicalizing normal experiences of sadness, grief, how do you pull that apart in your diagnosis? Once you hear them, those red flags that you hear, not sleeping well, you know, sort of an apathy, how do you separate that from sadness, something that may be normal to a clinical depression?
Sure, yeah. A lot of patients think that depression is just that, that that means that that's the person that, you know, doesn't get out of bed, they're just, you know, withdrawn, the house is dark, they don't go. Most people's depression, people know it, but the people close to them know it. Their coworkers don't know it. Sometimes they can hide it from some family members. It's not so dramatic that, boy, this person's just really depressed. So we kind of tease it out from the other stuff that's going on. It's often not, you know, my pet that I've had for 20 years has passed on, or I got fired from my job. Those are stress reactions. You know, that's sadness. And to be honest, most people don't go to the doctor for that sort of stuff. It's more the bigger red flags, as you had said.
Mm-hmm. So I imagine one of your lines of questioning would be to ascertain if something had recently happened, the death of a pet or loved one, that would cause a period of sadness.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. Now, this was interesting what you said, that we may not know, we might have, as I perhaps gave away, a cliched picture behavior of someone who is depressed. People can cover it up pretty well?
very well. They want to be successful. And so at work, you know, they'll keep doing, you know, their work, but people close to them will say, well, you just seem a little bit more withdrawn, or you just don't want to, you know, they don't want to go out after work. They don't want to go to the company picnic. They don't, you know, volunteer at a group meeting. The spouse often knows it, you know, that they can't hide it once they get home because they're, you know, withdrawn into that area there. They don't want to interact. But many of my patients tell me that they've been able to be quite successful. I mean, do their job, excel at their job, but in their own personal life, just not do well at all.
Mm-hmm. So how much can you as a family medicine physician do, and when do you know to hand it off to a specialist, for instance, a psychiatrist or a psychologist?
Well, in Iowa, all family physicians are trained in psychiatry, so we feel very comfortable with kind of the routine stuff. But in Iowa, we're at an extra burden. We are the 48th in the nation in psychiatrists per capita, so we have one per over 14,000 Iowans. There's one psychiatrist. So we really are the front line. We need to take care of this because it's often a 3-month wait before someone could get in to see a psychiatrist. So we have the training in it. We have the experience in it. We're used to doing that. When we have a patient come in with that, you know, first thing we'll do is see if that's the right diagnosis. You know, maybe it's their thyroid is off. Maybe there's something else that we need to address. They've got diabetes or some other health concern. So we make sure that it's not something else. We make sure that it is depression. And then the treatment options are identify, you know, counseling, medications.
Mm-hmm. So you just heard in the introduction me describing generally the concerns outlined in this opinion piece in the British Medical Journal. What is your reaction to that? Is there a tendency, perhaps, not speaking just of your clinic, but widely speaking, of over-diagnosing depression, medicalizing something that is just a part of normal human experience?
What I see from my patients, they do not want to be diagnosed with mental health, with a mental health problem. We know when I'm talking to my patients, I'll ask them, excuse me, anybody else in the family with this? No, nobody's been diagnosed with it. But I remember my uncle, and people would talk about him. You know, they would never go to the doctor, they would never see, but yeah, we kind of knew something was wrong with our uncle. And so now my patients are a little bit more comfortable discussing the issue of mental health. And so there may be some more diagnosis because they just didn't go to the doctor, they didn't get diagnosed. But I don't think physicians in particular, we want to, you know, give somebody a diagnosis when they're having a reaction to some stress. You know, they lost their job, they're having marital difficulty. That's not depression. People don't get depressed by that, and doctors really aren't confused with that. And so,
but will even when the diagnosis is not made, will an antidepressant be perhaps prescribed?
I'm sorry, Ben, I didn't understand the question.
Even though it's not recognized as clinical depression, will nevertheless an antidepressant be prescribed, perhaps?
Not likely. I mean, if it's situational, the antidepressants don't do well with that. You know, if you've lost your job and you're down because of that and you did well otherwise, if it's not true depression, the antidepressants don't really work. There's no street value for an antidepressant. I mean, narcotics have a street value because everybody feels different if they take a narcotic. Most of us don't think it's a high, but we feel differently. Whereas if you take an antidepressant, it won't make you happy. So it won't take somebody who's feeling good and make them feel better. It only takes people who are down and brings them up to baseline. You can't get high off of it.
Okay, Dr. Robert Lee, thank you very much. Family medicine physician with the Iowa Clinic. We appreciate it, Dr. Lee.
You're welcome, Ben. Thank you.
Talking this hour about the challenges of diagnosing depression, correctly identifying it and treating it. Now let's talk to two professors of psychiatry here in Iowa. Dr. Jess Fedorowicz is an associate professor of psychiatry and epidemiology and internal medicine at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. Dr. Fedorowicz, welcome to our program.
Thank you.
Also joining us in our Iowa City studio, Dr. Michael Flaum. He is a clinical professor of psychiatry at the University of Iowa Carver College of Medicine, also director of the Iowa Consortium for Mental Health. Dr. Flaum, welcome to you.
Thanks, Ben.
And we have you from two different perspectives, Dr. Fedorowicz, more of the coming from the research angle, and Dr. Flau more from the clinical side of things. Let's talk a little bit about the article. I believe you both read it, Dr. Fedorowicz. Give us your take on this concern.
Yeah, so the article presents a concern about depression being overdiagnosed, and particularly recent changes in the criteria by which we make the diagnosis, potentially increasing the number of people diagnosed, or at least that's the concern as presented in the editorial. And certainly there's data that individuals that present to their physicians or their clinicians, oftentimes the diagnosis that's made isn't accurate, and it is indeed a difficult diagnosis to make, especially when complicated by something like the presence of grief or bereavement or following the loss of a loved one. These studies suggest that indeed depression is often overdiagnosed, and that it's also underdiagnosed, and it's a difficult diagnosis to make.
Okay, so overdiagnosed, underdiagnosed, how do you see it, Dr. Flau?
Well, I got to say that I'm at the stage in my career, I've been doing this for a while, probably 30 years, and I'm at that stage where I think the more I know, the less I know. I basically agree with the overall sentiment of the editorial. I actually think the details are not the right ones. So I don't think that the recent change in the diagnostic criteria is likely to substantially broaden the number of people who are diagnosed. But I do think, and interestingly, unlike Dr. Lee, who as a family physician may see things a little bit more clearly, and maybe we as psychiatrists have the problem that my father used to describe as go to Midas, get a muffler. So by the time people walk into or knocking on our door, they're often pretty convinced of what they want. And most of them have been told what they want by extraordinarily successful advertising direct to consumer, right? So a big piece of this is that the big pharmaceutical industry has been extremely successful in teaching people that if the dishes pile up in their sink, then they might benefit from Prozac. And if they go to a family doctor and ask for that, they may be a little more cautious, but often I am very concerned that people will come to our clinic and come in with the notion of wanting an antidepressant and walk out with one.
Mm-hmm. And how do you deal with that, or how do the people in your clinic deal with that? What do you tell the doctors at your clinic?
Well, again, I'm an outlier. We are in an era where antidepressants are very readily prescribed. I will often tell my patients, if you don't have your Prozac or Celexa, just tap on the shoulder of the person next to you and ask them if you can take some of theirs. I mean, I think the data are something like 11% of adults are now taking antidepressants. But my point is that we have a pretty nonchalant attitude about the use of these medicines. And what my biggest concern is that I don't really think we understand the long-term downstream effects. I'm not sure that we have good enough data on what happens with a young person who's put on an antidepressant for a year, whether that could possibly change the natural history of their mood state.
Okay. We want to continue our discussion, but reach out also to our listeners. Join our discussion about depression, the use of antidepressants. Perhaps you have a personal experience with depression and antidepressants. 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org, our email. You can find us on Facebook to share your experience, or tweet us at IPR Talk. Before we do go to calls, you've referred to the change in diagnostic criteria concerning the diagnosis of depression. Clue us in onto what that is, Dr. Fedorowicz. What has been changed? There is an exclusion that has been added as well.
Or that has been removed. And that exclusion was referred to as the bereavement exclusion. And I'd like to so I'll explain what this is, and then I'll comment on Dr. Flom's statement that this will not likely change the prevalence of diagnoses, which I would agree with as well. So the prior criteria, which was in the DSM-IV, which is the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, had an exclusion that the diagnosis of depression could not be made in the 2 months following the death or loss of a loved one, and this was referred to as the bereavement exclusion. That has been removed, and that is the focus of the of this editorial in the British Medical Journal, was the removal of that and suggesting that this is going to broaden and increase the frequency at which depression is diagnosed. But the exclusion wasn't really just removed. It was replaced with pretty lengthy language encouraging clinicians to use their clinical judgment in determining, is this grief or is this depression? Looking at the clinical features, is it focused on loss? Does it come on its own? Is it getting better as time passes and coming in waves, as grief often does? Or is it persistent and not related to what's going on around the person? And also language to make sure that you take into account the patient's individual story, their cultural background, such that we're not saying that any grief or bereavement that goes past 2 months is somehow now depression. And so in many ways, I saw that as an improvement in allowing clinicians to take a story and use their judgment. So I think I'm not convinced of the thesis of that editorial that this is going to increase diagnoses. And my hope would be, in fact, that people use better clinical judgment in delineating these two things and not assuming that everyone is going to grieve for the same length or in the same way. And so I don't see that as happening. The other reason I don't see it as likely broadening is the very studies that the article cites suggesting that we have problems with overdiagnosis suggest that the previous criteria weren't being applied to begin with. So about 10 to 20% of people that walk in to see their primary care clinician will have depression. And based on studies of follow-ups of structured interviews to determine what people have that walk into the office, we can estimate that for, if let's say, 20 out of 100 well, we can say that 10 will receive the appropriate diagnosis for their depression. Another 15 will get diagnosed with depression that don't have it, and another 10 will have it and be missed. So we're really not doing as good of a job as we can about making the accurate diagnosis, and this article highlights that, and I think there's much improvements that can be made.
Dr. Flaum, to add to that before we go to our callers?
Oh, I would just say I agree with Dr. Fedorowicz on the bereavement criteria. I think it's misunderstood. I think people are suggesting that now you can be diagnosed with depression within a couple of weeks after bereavement, and that was certainly not the intent. I can say personally, as someone who went through a period of bereavement, I tried to go back to work 3 or 4 months after my loved one died and probably had the full syndrome of depression at that time. But thankfully, nobody made the mistake of calling it that. Everybody understood that it was bereavement, and it was a good 4 months afterward.
And were, if I may ask, in that case, were antidepressants needed?
Maybe if I would have sought them.
It would have been easy for you to get them.
Probably,
you were displaying
but,
all the
but I will tell you that in a community of psychiatrists, nobody suggested that.
Okay, 1-866-780-9100. Let's go to some of our listeners eager to join our conversation about identifying depression, how it's diagnosed, how it's treated. 1-866-780-9100. Also on our Facebook, some action there. Kevin on our Facebook page says, "I've taken Cetraline Zoloft." Is that what
it's
Cetraline and Zoloft for the past few years? It works beautifully for me, says Kevin. Let's go to our callers. Let's start off with Anthony. Anthony is in Northeast Iowa. Anthony, either you hung up or I accidentally clicked you off away. I'm sorry if that was my fault. Please call back. Shannon is with us from Davenport. Hi, Shannon.
Hi. Yeah, I just had a question. As I said, I'm kind of a victim of the marketing myself, but I have heard, and I'm not sure if it's true, that in terms of scientifically, that they don't entirely understand how many of these medications work, that we get a desired result, but the actual, you know, we don't understand it as well as, say, something like penicillin and exactly what it's doing to the body. Is that true?
Okay, great question. Well, what do we understand about depression? I guess we don't even understand the ailment. Do we understand the way these medications are working?
Well, Dr. Fedorowicz and I may have different perspectives on this. We've made great strides in understanding the brain over the last couple of decades, but there are certain things we really get, You know, like if I bang on your knee and watch it move,
the reflex.
I pretty much get how that works. But truly understanding higher cognitive functions, emotions, mood, it's pretty sophisticated stuff. And we're making progress in that area. But to say that we really understand how these medicines work, I think we understand that they do work, but I don't know. Dr. Fedorowicz, you may have a different perspective.
Yeah, that would resonate with me as well. I think sometimes we overstate how little we know and sometimes overstate how much we know, depending on the context. Mm-hmm. These medicines are really empirical treatments, not rational treatments. And what I mean by that is that we know that they work, but they weren't designed because we understood exactly what was going on and then designed something to fix it. And certainly we know what sort of mechanisms or what sort of things that when medications do that they're likely to result in depression. But the full process is incompletely understood. Getting to the often overstating how much we don't know as well, though this is true in other areas of medicine as well. Mm-hmm. There's many things that we don't know. For instance, even post-traumatic arthritis, which seems simple enough, right? Someone gets a trauma to a joint and they develop arthritis. We don't really know if that's related to loss of blood circulation or inflammation. And I think similarly with depression, we have some ideas of things that may be going on, but certainly far from understood. One thing I'd add, too, is I don't think this is a single condition.
Right.
It's likely very heterogeneous. So one person's depression may not be the same as others, just like not all fever is caused by the same thing.
Right.
If you've just joined us, my guest, Dr. Jess Fedorowicz and Dr. Michael Flaum, psychiatrists, professors of psychiatry at the University of Iowa. And I wondered, we've got a number of calls. Can both of you stay for the full hour, or does that work out? Okay, Dr. Fedorowicz can. Dr. Flaum,
I turned my pager off, so I'm good.
All right. 1-866-780-9100. Let's, before the break, get another call squeezed in here. Cheryl is with us from Cedar Rapids. Hi, Cheryl.
Good morning. I'm finding this conversation to be quite fascinating.
Good. What is your question?
Well, there's probably a question within maybe what my statements. I come from a family with
We've got about a minute before the break, so please be brief, Cheryl, if possible. Sorry.
Oh, okay. With a very, very long history of many mental illnesses,
mm-hmm.
and I suffer from depression myself. And one comment that I liked that Dr. Lee mentioned was that the medication cannot make you happy. It just brings you up to a baseline. And I have found that to be true, because I always kind of wondered, well, how come I'm not happier? How come I'm not laughing like other people and stuff?
I see.
Then just like reading articles and listening to other medical people talk was that the human element is like the other part of the equation. You know, people accepting you, I get picked on at work a lot. I get harassed. And the last girl who started screaming at me literally in a locker room, what is wrong with you? What is so wrong with you? Why do you creative people all tend to have stuff wrong with your head?
Mm.
And I looked at her and I said, you know what? I cannot help the way that I am. Okay. You either accept me as I am or we can't be friends. I said, I can't help how I am.
Okay, Cheryl, we have to go to break. Thank you very much for sharing your story from Cedar Rapids. Take care, Cheryl. And join our discussion as we continue after a short break. We're talking about depression, how to identify it, how to treat it, possibly it being misdiagnosed. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. And we're so glad to have you with us on this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour we're talking about the challenges of depression, of diagnosing clinical depression, correctly identifying it, and treating it. Join our discussion, 1-866-780-9100. In just a few moments, we'll be talking with a clinical psychologist, the executive director of Agra Wellness, who will talk about some of the special depression problems that farmers and ranchers can face. But let's continue our conversation with Dr. Michael Flaum, clinical professor of psychiatry at the University of Iowa, and Dr. Jess Fedorowicz, associate professor of psychiatry, epidemiology, and internal medicine at the UI. And let's field some of your questions, getting right back to our phones. Anthony is with us from Northeast Iowa. Apologies. I think we cut you off, Anthony. You're back with us. Thank you for calling us back.
Quite all right. For the first time, it wasn't my phone. So that's a good thing on the up note.
What have you got for us?
In my early 20s, I was kind of in a legal dispute and had some classes I had to go to, and they suggested that I went to a doctor and got seen for depression as well. I was in the room with her for about maybe 5-10 minutes and walked out with a couple prescriptions for depression without any referrals to a therapist or a psychiatrist or anything. After a couple months, some really weird thoughts and ideas and about 50 pounds, I just kind of figured that I probably didn't have depression. So I just kind of stopped taking them, did some serious introspection and some self-finding, and now I couldn't be happier except for I can't get rid of the weight that I gained with them.
So in your opinion, Anthony, they were not needed and you did not have clinical depression?
Yeah, I didn't find that they really, I think I was probably just more of kind of in a slump at the time. I didn't really have depression. It just made me feel really, really weird on the inside. Mm-hmm. I had some really crazy ideas and thoughts, but after I got off of them, I mean, it was a complete 180 for me.
Okay, Anthony, thank you for your story from Northeast Iowa. Dr. Flaum, what do you make of this story?
Well, unfortunately, I don't think it's a very unusual story. Mm. I think one of the things that is really problematic, Dr. Lee talked about the shortage of psychiatrists, and one of the responses to the shortage of psychiatrists has been that 15-minute visits have become a norm. I don't know how other psychiatrists can figure out whether somebody has depression or not in 15 minutes. Apparently this happens, but I don't get it. And I worry if someone walks in and has a brief appointment and walks out with a prescription, that would worry me.
Right. Anthony there extracted himself from the situation, seems to be fine now. But what are some dangers that could happen if you are prescribed an antidepressant and really don't need it, Dr. Fedorowicz?
Yeah, I think his story highlights nicely that these medicines are not without side effects, some of which, for many of which, weight gain is one of them. Other side effects can be even more severe, although are less frequent, but it's not uncommon for people to have worsening anxiety during the acute titration of antidepressants. Patients can have nausea, vomiting, sexual side effects. And so these medications are not without side effects, and it highlights the importance of trying to get the diagnosis correct, because if the diagnosis isn't correct, the medications aren't going to be of benefit.
Here's an email from one of our listeners, Jordan. I started taking antidepressants, citalopram?
Citalopram
during 2011 after a period of what may have been grief. I have been taking them regularly until this past summer. I went off the medication for 3 weeks and quickly spiraled back into the same feelings. I worry that sort of dependency and having not dealt properly with my grief, but I'm afraid to stop taking them because it has caused me to spiral into serious sadness in the past. So how many people would be in that situation, and what is the way out of it if you perhaps were prescribed an antidepressant in a period of grief or sadness and now want to stop taking the medication? What is the path, Dr. Fedorowicz?
Yeah, so that brings up several important points. So one is one of the reasons the bereavement exclusion was removed was the idea that grief or bereavement could precipitate a depressive episode. So if someone's had several depressions in the past and a loved one dies, that could be enough to set them into a new episode, and we don't want to miss that. And I don't want to make a diagnosis here whether the person was or wasn't in a depressive episode. Coming off of medications, patients can experience a withdrawal from the medication, and oftentimes medications do need to be tapered or tapered slowly. Sometimes that withdrawal may be confused as a recurrence of the depression. Sometimes it is a recurrence of the depression, and that's important to work with your provider to determine whether or not that's withdrawal, whether or not that's a recurrence of depression, or what's going on.
But, okay. Many people out there wanting to get a little bit of advice and a question answered. Let's go to Lisa in Iowa City. Hi, Lisa.
Hi. So, my question is along the same lines as the last question. I just caught the last bit of it, but I've been on an antidepressant for 2 years, and it's been very effective in my life. And it's, you know, it's sort of allowed me to reach goals that I haven't been able to reach in the past before my severe episode that I had that sort of manifested in me taking an antidepressant. And I was wondering, so I've been on this for 2 years, and, you know, what's the next step? I feel like things in my life have changed, and, you know, I want to get off this antidepressant. And I'm also, you know, I'm a single mother, and I often forget to take my medication, and I experience these withdrawal periods, and it's
okay.
Awful.
Let's get you some advice, Lisa, because I think there are others in your situation. Dr. Flaum.
As Dr. Fedorowicz mentioned, really important question to talk to your provider about. There are pretty good guidelines about when antidepressants really are recommended to continue indefinitely. So, for example, if you had three or more severe episodes, that would be a good reason to continue them. There's also some data that if you have a severe episode later in life, you may want to be more careful about continuing. But if you had one episode and you had a good response, it is not at all unreasonable to, in a very planful way, gradually taper off. But I would do that in the context of discussions with my provider.
Good luck with that, Lisa. Thank you for calling. Let's field this email from Colleen. My daughter, writes Colleen, started taking, here's another drug, fluoxetine?
Yes.
Fluoxetine.
Prozac.
When she was 15, she's now 21. When fluoxetine was no longer effective, she started on Lexapro. Mm-hmm. Once a person has started on an antidepressant, do they need to continue to take it for the rest of their lives? A big question that you actually referred to in terms of long-term. We don't know the long-term consequences of this, Dr. Flaum. So this is a question that kind of feeds into that. Dr. Fedorowicz?
Yeah. So I think Dr. Flaum's last answer, I think, addresses this pretty well. Getting to the long-term piece, our longest-term clinical trials go out about 2 years. And most of the clinical trials don't even go past a year. So we certainly know that the benefit for them, for those that respond, continues at least out to 2 years, although the overall risk decreases the further you get away from your episode. So this is certainly a question to talk about with your provider and similar thoughts to Dr. Flaum about which individuals we would consider long-term treatment with.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about individual cases. Can you identify, either of you, sort of trends you see happening in the field of psychiatry in the treatment of depression that both several decades of experience put together? You have them, Dr. Flaum, you especially. Do you see us moving in a certain direction in diagnosis and treatment that may continue on into the future?
I think one of the unfortunate trends is that perhaps we are more reliant on medication and less reliant on psychotherapies, which are highly effective but more resource intensive. So we have very good data to suggest that a variety of the conditions that are successfully treated with antidepressant medications can also be successfully treated with good evidence-based psychotherapies. But those, frankly, cost more.
Let's go to Chad in Oskaloosa. Hi, Chad. Welcome to our program.
Yes. My issue is with my wife. I've been married for 30 years, and she's abusing medicine. They have prescribed her years ago with Prozac, and then it was Zavibrid, and I'm not sure of the new one now. But the problem is then they always give her Valium. And when she just started this new medicine about 3 weeks ago, they gave her Xanax and took her off the Valium. Mm-hmm. And, for instance, she took 38 Xanax in 6 days.
Yeah.
And she doesn't realize that she doesn't think she's abusing them.
Yeah.
But the really weird issue was I got her. She was the drug Bentyl for the stomach. She was taking the generic. I think it was like DOC something. It's a blue pill.
I wonder if I can interrupt you because you're making a really important point, which is actually one of the benefits of most antidepressants that we think of is that they do not typically induce what we call tolerance or dependence, which is not the case for the medicines like Valium and Xanax that you mentioned. Those are anti-anxiety medicines, and the biggest problem with those medicines is that most people, once they take them, will require more and more, and their effects will be less and less. The nice thing about most of the antidepressants that we're talking about is that that is not the case, and they're actually pretty hard to abuse.
Mm-hmm. So the difference there, the antidepressant, will raise you to a baseline, whereas these narcotics that you mentioned will give you an actual high?
Well, I'm not sure I would put it that way, but yes, the medicines like Valium and Xanax, you take one and within a couple of hours, you're going to feel differently. That is not at all the case with most of the medicines that are in the antidepressant class, any of the medicines that are in the antidepressant class, which you really have to take over a period of weeks to months consistently in order to get the effects.
Dr. Michael Flaum with us, along with Dr. Jess Fedorowicz, professors of psychiatry at the University of Iowa. We want to add one more person to our conversation before the hour gets away from us. Joining us me now, an Iowa psychologist and farmer who has studied and written about stress and depression among farmers and ranchers. Joining us by phone, Michael Roseman, clinical psychologist and executive director of Agra Wellness, Inc. It's a nonprofit organization that links farmers and ranchers in seven states with behavioral health services, as well as free legal advice and financial management. Also, Michael Roseman, the owner of Rosa Blanda Farms in Harlan, Iowa. You're joining us from Harlan. Welcome to our program, Michael.
Thank you.
What special mental health challenges are there for farmers when it comes to the topic of depression?
Well, farmers have a somewhat higher incidence of depression than persons in most other occupational groups. We also know that there is a higher suicide rate among people engaged in agriculture. The rate of suicide of people who are involved in farming is about 60% higher than persons who are of a similar background but not engaged in farming. We think that the increased incidence of depression is due to at least a couple of factors. One factor is exposure to certain types of pesticides in several classes. Some of these pesticides are the organophosphates, carbamates, which aren't used very much, and neonicotinoids. The neonicotinoids don't have a strong research to.
So there are research underpinnings for what you're saying about the farm chemicals?
There are, especially regarding the organophosphates. But now that's only one factor. I think there are other factors. There is a great deal of stress involved in farming because of uncertainties that are beyond the control of farm people. These include such things as weather events, sometimes politics, crop diseases, a host of circumstances. Mm-hmm. And finally, I think there is what I would call the agrarian imperative. I think it is an inherited drive to acquire the land and resources necessary to produce essentials for life: food and fiber, and increasingly renewable energy. This drive, I think, helps to set us up for working terribly hard, facing a great deal of adversity and trying to overcome it, being fairly high risk-taking, and all of these factors then make us overreact to threats against the welfare of our farm enterprise. So if we're threatened economically or in other ways, we try too terribly hard to overcome the stress and deplete ourselves eventually of serotonin and norepinephrine. I do happen to know Dr. Flaum, who was just on the preceding section of this program, and I guess I would say that he probably knows a great deal about what happens with the depletion of serotonin and norepinephrine, as he was
less
talking.
Than you might think, Mike.
Yeah, Dr. Flaum is still with us, so I don't know if you wanted to comment on that. You founded, Michael Roseman, you founded Agra Wellness in 2001. So what services does it provide that in this seven-state area that help out the concerns that we're talking about?
Well, AgriWellness is temporarily struggling with financial insufficiency, largely because there's not sufficient federal resources that we depend on. It was part of the Farm Bill in 2008. It was approved but never funded. But AgriWellness is intended and did for many years link farmers who called telephone hotlines like the Iowa Concern Hotline. They would be linked with a telephone counselor who would help them work through issues, could also refer them on for other types of services that were needed, such as legal advice, financial advice, and perhaps even more importantly, to undertake counseling from persons who are trained and have some knowledge in agriculture as well as in behavioral health.
Mm-hmm. Can you point, Michael Roseman, to some real-life examples where mental health problems should have been given more attention than they were?
Well, one circumstance that comes to mind immediately was the farm crisis of the 1980s. There was a time when the suicide rate rose to almost four times the rate of suicide preceding the onset of that era of economic difficulty. It subsequently declined as conditions improved, but as I started to say at the very beginning, the self-imposed death rate of farmers is about 60% higher than for non-farmers.
Mm-hmm. So you talked earlier about, I think, what you call the agrarian imperative, the stoic personality often farmers have. And I wonder, how do you consult farmers, tell them to avoid some of the mental pitfalls that accompany this sort of psychology?
Well, farmers are in control of their behavior. It's one of the few factors that farmers have almost complete control over. They are able to determine how much sleep they get, whether they exercise properly, whether they talk about issues that are important and troubling with spouses and other trusted individuals, whether they take time for recreation, maybe for prayer. All of these behaviors are under our control, and they have a lot to do with our well-being. So we can control, to some extent, how we handle stress by managing it properly. And I would disagree with what Dr. Flom said earlier that, you know, that's costly. I think a few sessions of educational kinds of counseling can go a long ways toward helping farm people and other people, for that matter, know how to manage their own stress level and their own behaviors with, let's say, an educated approach to managing themselves.
Okay. Michael Roseman, thank you very much, clinical psychologist and director of AgriWellness, Inc. Let's squeeze in one more caller. We have our psychiatrist still here. Elizabeth is joining us from Urbandale. We have just a minute or two left. Elizabeth, what was the point you wanted to make after listening to our program today?
I just wanted to make point that medications for depression, for these sorts of things, are not necessarily what people do not need. My youngest sister struggled all through school, barely graduated high school, and in her first year of community college, she attempted suicide twice, ended up hospitalized for very serious issues from that. But then she was finally diagnosed with bipolar disorder, which is, while not specifically depression, mm-hmm. it is in this sort of lump. And now she's graduating very soon with her master's from University of Michigan. She graduated with her bachelor's.
I don't want to cut you short, Elizabeth. It sounds like a success story thanks to medication. Is that what you're driving at? I wanted to get a comment
from
one of – okay, good, Elizabeth. Thank you for your call. Let's go to Dr. Fedorowicz for a closing comment, perhaps tied to Elizabeth's comment and experience.
Yeah, thanks for calling in, Elizabeth. I think that's an important point, and that's one of my concerns when people only look at the over-prescribing side of the coin, is that there are people that we can help, and we want to make sure sure that we reach them. But it's important to get an appropriate and accurate diagnosis and for the treatment to be the right treatment for that person. There is some data suggesting that you're more likely to respond to an antidepressant relative to a placebo if you have a more severe depression and less likely to respond with a milder form. And so we do want to make sure that people that need help and that can benefit from it get it and aren't discouraged. And we don't want to miss those folks either.
Okay. Thank you very much. Dr. Jess Fedorowicz, Associate Professor of Psychiatry, Epidemiology, and Internal Medicine at the University of Iowa, along with Dr. Michael Flom, who has also come into our Iowa City studio, clinical professor of psychiatry at the University of Iowa and director of the Iowa Consortium for Mental Health. Dr. Flom, Dr. Fedorowicz, thank you for your time and for your advice here. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Ben.
Thanks. River to River is produced by Ben Stanton, Emily Woodbury, and Sarah Bowden, and our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. Tomorrow's Wednesday. You know what that means. It's Politics Wednesday. We'll talk about, well, Governor Christie, I'm sure, a number of other things. The governor just gave his speech today. I'm sure that will be on our docket. We hope you'll join us again tomorrow for more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Have a good rest of your afternoon.